looking for.
For I think that's better. I think that's better.
Take out the Greek text and do a little reading again this morning. Three,
four, John, and what you're dealing with.
What's that? Yeah. Well, hopefully less violence each time we read it.
Okay. I don't know if we'll bite off any more today. We'll just try to polish what we had. I think we'll go all the way from verse 1 to verse 18 here, and do it slowly so everybody can follow along here. And just again, as you're reading 5 minutes each day, you know, you want to keep checking, and when we do this often enough in class to make checks so you don't learn any bad habits and so forth, unless you're listening to tapes, you can probably pick up things there. So kind of keep brushing up on it, keep working on it, just a constant vigilance here to get more and more familiar with it. So we'll start with verse 1, we'll go reasonably slow, and we'll all do it together here first time. En arche ein o logos Kai, ho logos, ein pros ton theon. Kai, theos, ein ho logos. Hutos, ein en arche, pros ton theon. Panta di autu egeneto, kai choris autu egeneto ude hen. Ho gegonen en auto zoe ein, kai he zoe ein tophos ton anthropon. Kai tophos en te scotia phainē, kai he scotia auto u katelaben. Egeneto anthropos apestalmenos para theu onoma auto Ioannes. Hutos eilten eis marturion, hina marturese peri tu photos, hina pontus pistusosin di autu. Uc ein ekenos tophos, al hina marturese peri tu photos. Ein tophos to alethenon, ho photize panta anthropon, erchomenon, eis ton kosmon. En to kosmo ein, kai ho kosmos di autu egeneto, kai ho kosmos auto uc egno. Eis ta idia elthen, kai hoi idioi auton u parelabon. Hosoi de elabon auton, edoken autois exousion techna theu genestai, tois pistuusin eis ton onoma autu. Hoi uc ex haimaton ude ec thelematos sarkos, ude ec thelematos andros, au ec theu egenethesan. Kai ho logos sarx egeneto, kai eskenosen en hemin, kai etheasamatha tein doxan autu, doxan hos monogenus para patros, pleres charitos kai aletheas. Ioannes marture peri autu, kai kekragen legon, hutos ein hon epon, ho opiso mu erchomenos, emprosthen mu gegonen, hoti protos mu ein. Hoti ek tu pleromatos autu, hemes pantas elabonen, kai charin anti charitos. Hoti ho nomos dia mouseos eduthe, he charis kai he aletheia dia Iesu Christu egeneto. Theon udes he oraken popote, monogenes theos, ho on eston kopon tu patros, ekenos exegesato. Okay? How are most of you doing there? Are you able to follow along reasonably? You lose it once in a while and then hopefully catch up again and so forth. Okay. Just keep working on it. It's the only thing I can say. Just practice, 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 practice over and over again. And the Greek gets a little bit more difficult. There's a little bit longer words as we go on here. And later on, of course, we'll be getting into other portions of the New Testament that are a little bit more difficult yet. Okay. Let's continue then with yesterday's discussion in chapter 9 on adjectives. Didn't have a workbook assignment for today. Hopefully we'll have one for tomorrow here if we get through this. After adjectives, we'll pick up the dative and the genitive and dative case in the next two chapters, and then we'll have our full paradigm for first, second declensions. Then we'll take a look at accent rules, and then we get to get into the verbs in chapter 12. It's lots of fun. Okay. Now, we left off on page 53 here, just about to talk about predicate positions for adjectives. Now, remember what we're discussing is the fact that the adjective holds different positions relative to the noun. If the noun is an anarthrous noun, meaning a noun with no article, then the adjective, if it's attributive, can occur before or after the noun. So that was our first point here on page 52. Then also we saw that an adjective that is attributive modifying an articular noun has one of two positions. It can either come between the article and the noun. In other words, you'll have article, adjective, noun, or you'll have article, noun, article, adjective. The article repeated and the adjective being put afterwards. So if you put the article, if you put the adjective after the noun, there's a need to repeat the article. So that's where we left off. Now, I'll just read again on page 53. Positions 1 and 2 are called the first and second attributive positions, respectively. When an adjective has one of these positions, it has the meaning of modifying the noun, as in the equivalent English construction indicated. The first attributive position is more common than the second. So the first is more common than the second. The second actually seems to have a little bit more emphasis than the first, at least more emphasis on the adjective. In other words, if I were to say, ho pistos diakonos, the faithful minister, or say, ho diakonos ho pistos, they both mean the faithful minister, but the second one seems to put a little bit more stress on the pistos, on the faithful aspect of it. Just because you kind of separated that out and put the article again in front of it, it tends to give a little bit more of a punch to that particular thought. Yes?
In a sentence, anything else separate these two? Can you put diakonos out in front somewhere and all this other garbage in between and then ho pistos on the end?
No, you'll have those following right afterwards. They'll always be together. The only thing you might have is if you got a series of adjectives. And you see, if you've got a series of adjectives, suppose I wanted to say the deacon who's good and faithful, then I might say ho diakonos, ho kalos, ho pistos. In other words, I might have another adjective phrase in between there, but nothing else is going to come in there. Yeah?
In that case, do they ever say just ho pistos diakonos, blah, 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 and there's some off without...
You can if you put them in the front. In other words, if you put them in the first position, ho kalos pistos, et cetera, diakonos, you can do that. If you're going to put them afterwards, then you're going to have the article in front of each one. Otherwise, you can get it confused with this next position that we'll get to here, this predicate position. And so you might find something, I don't want to get ahead of it. Why don't I just read this next part here, and you'll see a predicate position. Then you'll see another situation. Sometimes you'll see a mixture between adjectives in the attributive position and in the predicate position. In other words, you can get a mixture between these two, and I'll show you how that's done in a moment here when we look at this. Okay, the other positions an adjective may have with articular nouns are called predicate positions. And so we've got two predicate positions now. The first one, Roman numeral 3 here, in the first predicate position, the adjective precedes both the noun and its article, but has no article of its own. So an example is pistos ho theos. Pistos ho theos. Notice the adjective pistos is coming out in front of both the article and its noun, and it has no article itself. And this is translated not the faithful God, but God is faithful. So there's a different translation for this predicate position. God is faithful. So you can see that this position is very important. If I just reverse the positions of the article and the adjective here, I change the sentence completely, or change the statement. If I said ho pistos theos, that would be the first attributive position, and I'd be saying the faithful God. But when I say pistos ho theos, I'm saying God is faithful. In fact, that's all I need for a complete sentence in Greek. The verb to be is being translated in the English idiom, but you can see there's no verb to be at all in the Greek. There's no verb at all. Now, that doesn't mean, some people term it this way, the verb is understood. But that language is, it's all right to a certain extent, but the problem is that in Greek, the verb isn't really being understood. The verb isn't needed at all, because in Greek, they've got a different grammatical mechanism that's going on here. You don't need a verbal idea. In English, when we translate such a thing into English, we do need the verb to be. Otherwise, we're going to lose the sense of it. So I think rather than saying the verb is understood, what we more accurately say is that English idiom requires the verb to be, whereas the Greek construction is just equating these things without any verb stated. But we will translate it, God is faithful, because there's an assertion that's taking place here, and a statement, and all you need for a sentence is a construction like this. Okay, so pistos ho theos, God is faithful. And you have to really watch this. After a while, you get used to the feeling for the different positions. At first, it's pretty mechanical. You just got to remember where that article is relative to the adjective and the noun. Okay, the second predicate position, the adjective again has no article but follows the articular noun. So in this case, we let the adjective follow the noun but don't repeat the article, and that'll make the difference. So, ho nomos hagios, the law is holy. The law is holy. Now, if I said ho nomos ho hagios, that would be the holy law. So the difference then, if I take that article, if I don't repeat the article and put the adjective afterwards, I've got what's called the second predicate position. So on the predicate positions, basically what's happening is that the noun, the articular noun, stays intact. The article's on noun. You can put the adjective out in front of it or behind it, with no article being repeated if it's behind it. And that's the predicate position. Yes?
It's almost kind of obvious, but I'm sure it is. This can only happen with articular
nouns. Right. Only with articular nouns. Right. With anarthrous nouns, you have ambiguities. Because if there's no article there, you see, if you associate an adjective with an anarthrous noun, that could be either predicate or attributive, and your context will have to decide. Usually it's not too difficult. Those situations don't occur that frequently. When they do occur, the predicate positions are usually discerned by the fact that there's no other verb in the sentence or something like that, and it has to be. If it's attributive, there'll probably be another verb in this type of thing. So it's not as difficult as it might seem in that case. But with the articular noun, you've got to be very careful about the positioning of these things. Okay. Let's look at section 69 then and pursue this idea of the way these are translated a little bit more carefully. It should be noted that the English translations of the Greek examples in 3 and 4 above are sentences with structure parallel to that of sentence 6 of section 45. This room is stuffy. Here we encounter an important difference between the structures of Greek and English. The English sentence 6 and those in 3 and 4 above all have a structure which may be represented by the formula subject verb adjective, or more generally by noun 1 verb adjective. Where noun 1, the subject S is a noun of the in first position in the sentence, V is an equative verb, and ADJ is an adjective. The structures of the Greek examples in 3 and 4, however, are entirely different. We may represent them as adjective, article, noun, and article, noun, adjective. So these are the predicate positions here. And where T represents the article, noun in the sub N means noun in the nominative case, and ADJ represents an adjective, agreeing with the noun, of course. There is nothing in either Greek example to correspond to the equative verb in the English equivalents. Yet the Greek examples are complete sentences just as much as their English equivalents are. It is not correct to say that a verb is understood in Greek. It is true that we have to supply a verb, usually is or are, when we translate such Greek structures, but the Greeks were perfectly satisfied with them without any verb at all. The word order here is the Greek in the Greek this time, rather than in English, indicates the structural meaning. So here's a kind of a switch. We've been used to finding Greek not caring about word order, but English caring about word order. Here we find that the Greek is concerned about the word order. Here's an instance in which word order is important in Greek, and the position of the adjective relative to the noun. There are a few other areas too, and they're mostly related to this type of an idea with certain other types of adjectives. But there is where word order is important. Yes?
The difference in word order between numbers 3 and 4 are different from stress. God is faithful in the first one.
Oh, yes.
Versus Allah.
In your predicate positions, 3 and 4 here, the difference in word order will generally translate into a difference in stress. If you put the adjective first, there's a little bit more stress on the adjective. If you put the noun first, a little bit more stress on the noun. Right? You get that. You pick up that feeling. It's really easy to do. And the more we're familiar with it, the more. But as far as basic meaning, there's no difference. And again, whenever you have word order variants, a couple possibilities, usually there's a stress variation in them. All right, so let's maybe summarize these four positions we have for adjectives from what we've seen, and just diagram them the way you diagram them. Four total positions now with articular nouns. So with articular nouns, we've got two predicate positions, so we'll start here with one. We'll start with the attributive, and then two with the predicate. And under this, we've got two basic ones here. First attributive, I'll just call it first here because these are the terms that are normally used. First, second. Okay, your first attributive position, you're going to have the article. We'll just use T for article. Adjective, noun, and For the second attributive position, I'm not designating what case this is because this could occur an attributive. An adjective can modify an attributive noun in just about any case there is. In any case there is. Okay, now the second attributive position is a matter of article, noun, article, adjective. Okay, then for your predicate positions, the first and second, the first predicate position is one in which we place the adjective before, and we just have it right here, this diagram three, adjective, article, noun. And this time the noun will be in the nominative case because it's a predicate construction. And whenever you've got a predicate construction like this, that's going to be a sentence structure, and this noun is going to have to be the nominative, so we can designate that there. And then in the second predicate position, we just have article, noun, and the nominative, adjective. Now, the only difference here, you see, in the predicate position is to shift from first to second, you just take the adjective and slide it over here. That's all you've done. You haven't done anything as far as this noun and article situation. Whereas in your attributive positions, you see, your adjective can come between the article and the noun here. And here, the adjective comes following, but the article is repeated. So that'll kind of give us an idea of what these positions are. And this is the way they're labeled. These are the two attributive positions. These are the two predicate positions. The translations in the predicate positions, of course, come out with a verb to be of some sort. And where you're stating that the noun is such and such, and stating it plainly as being described as adjective. Whereas these others, you might say these constitute a whole sentence, really. Whereas these constitute only a part of a sentence, only a functional unit within the sentence. This whole thing might be a subject, this whole thing might be the object or indirect object or something like that. Whereas in this case, these things are the whole sentence. Not to say that there might not be a compound sentence in which you have, you know, a comma and another statement or something like that, but as far as what's needed to constitute a sentence, that's all you need in this predicate construction. Okay. So, section 70 here goes on to take this a step further and mentions the fact that even though you can get by without the verb to be in Greek, and you can use this predicate construction, there are cases in which the verb to be will appear. And when it does, it kind of relaxes some of the conditions that are established here by this predicate position. And it also is more emphatic. Let's look at the examples here. Greek sentences with a structure, noun and the nominative, verb, adjective, or subject, verb, adjective, with variable order, where V is an equative verb, also occur. So you will get situations in which you have something similar to this predicate construction, but you have the verb to be expressed. You don't need it, but you can go ahead and express it if you want to. And if you do, there's usually more emphasis. So look at some examples here. Ta hematia egeneto leuka. Okay, we have the garments, ta hematia egeneto verb. This is an equative verb. It's the verb ginomai, which is the verb to become. And leuka means white. So the garments became white. Now, you're especially going to use this if you're using the verb to become rather than the verb to be, then you usually need to express that because you're not going to, the predicate construction is just going to have the verb to be. It's not going to have the idea of become, not unless you have some real powerful context to make it clear. So the garments became white. Now, this is still a predicate-like construction. Hematia is nominative, subject, and leuka is the adjective also in the nominative case. And now you've got an equative verb connecting the two. Okay, this next one is using the form of the verb to be. Ein enantios ho animos. The wind was contrary. Okay, you've got the verb ein there is a form of the verb to be. And ho animos is the wind. And enantios is the adjective, contrary. And here, notice that you've got your adjective and then the noun. This could be considered a predicate position. In other words, if you took the ein off there, then you would still be saying the wind is contrary, and then if the context was in the past, you could still translate it, the wind was contrary. But putting the ein there makes it no doubt about the tense value, and it also puts more emphasis on it. The wind was contrary. It's a little bit more powerful. This word animos there, for example, the only cognate I can think of is an anemometer, which measures wind, probably derived from that word. Okay. Then, Eleutheroi eisen hoi huioi, the sons are free. Okay, here we have the adjective first, then the verb, then the subject. And again, the verb being stated, eisen, like this, makes it more emphatic. And also, the word order becomes not as important now when you have the equative verb stated. You don't have to have the adjective right next to the noun, right next to the article of the noun. You see, now we've got a verb coming between them. But using the verb form and stating this relationship without any ambiguity at all releases the constraints as far as the word order is concerned. Of course, you're still not going to split up the article and its noun and so forth, but still you've got a little bit more freedom as far as the construction is concerned. So when you have a clearly stated equative verb, then you don't have to be concerned about this word order relationship. But if you're wanting to have a predicate construction without using a form of the verb, then you have to observe one of these two positions. Okay? Yes, Mark?
I think you already answered the question, but when you have adjectives and they have a predicate construction, the equative verb would be is in most cases, unless the context is specifically in the past tense. And
right.
Sure.
It could be was, or it could even be will be, if the context required. But for the purposes of all the exercises, unless you've got obvious context, assume it's just the present tense. So always assume it's present tense unless, for example, if I give you an example on a test, and I give you a phrase, the sons are free or something like that, I would expect you to use a predicate construction and... Or if I give you a predicate construction, I expect you to translate in English as the form of the verb to be in the present, unless the context is really demanding otherwise. But I don't think it will, on test anyway, you need to worry about that. In translation, you'll have to watch that. Sometimes there'll be a whole narrative that's talking about a past situation, and everything's going on in the past, but it's a whole historical narrative. And when you see a predicate construction in that circumstance, then you're to assume that it's past tense. And same with the future. Those probably won't occur very frequently, but if they do, then that's the situation. You'll see that kind of thing a lot more in Hebrew than you do in Greek. Okay, section 71 then. Greek adjectives also occur in syntactic positions ordinarily occupied by nouns, and may in such situations be said to be used as nouns, or to have the functions of nouns. This use is quite similar to that of English. Although occasionally a clearer translation results if a noun is supplied or if one or ones is added. So what he's saying is that in Greek, just like in English, an adjective can be functioning like a noun. And there's a term for that that he hasn't used here, but he'll use later on, called a substantive. Substantive is something that's acting like a noun. Most often adjectives, but we'll find other things that will also act like nouns. And we'll come into that idea some more when we deal with participles, because participles are essentially verbal adjectives, and so they're going to do the same kind of things that adjectives do here. So this is a kind of thing we'll be getting used to a lot more in the future as we study Greek, but we should be aware of just the basics of it right now. You can take an adjective and treat it just like a noun. Stick an article on it. That's usually one of the important keys to identifying situations where an adjective is functioning like a noun is the use of the article. But that isn't always the case, because, of course, sometimes they may be anarthrous. But you'll usually be able to tell quite clearly from the context that this is what's happening. Let's look at a couple of examples here, and you can see what I mean. Eson tai hoi eskatoi protoi. The last shall be first. Okay, now notice what we've done here. Eskatoi here, the word eskatos is an adjective meaning last. And so the word is normally used as an adjective. But here, the word is being given an article, and it's standing as the subject of the sentence. The last shall be first. And so he's saying, often, if you want to make it unambiguous, you could translate it the last ones or something like that. Add the word ones in there to indicate that this is becoming a substantive. Most of the time, we don't need to do that. We can understand quite plainly in English, the last shall be first. When we mean last things, last ones, last people, whatever, it's not... It's not just a pure adjectival idea. It's standing as a noun and is functioning that way in the sentence. So there's a good example. Then in the next one, we have a whole list of these. Tu floi anablepusin kai choloi peripatusin leproi katharizontai kai kofoi akuusin kai necroi egerontai kai ptochoi evangelizontai. Should have had you read that one. That's a good one. Okay. But what it's saying, tufloi means blind, and choloi means lame, and leproi means leprous, and kofoi means deaf, and necroi means dead, and plochoi means poor. So in this case, the translation is blind men receive their sight. He puts men in parentheses here, but because the word men isn't there. But it's blind ones, you see. Blind something. It's just they've taken the adjective for blind and made it into a noun. And it's obvious that it's the noun because you've got verb forms attached to each one of these, and they're functioning like subjects of all of those. So blind men receive their sight, lame men walk, leprous men are cleansed, deaf men hear, and so forth, etc., etc. Yes, Glenn? Mm-hmm. Okay. Good question. What you'll find is this: if it's talking obviously about men, it'll be masculine. If it's a mixed group, you know, where it could be men or women, it'll be masculine. In other words, they're using the masculine forms to deal with mixed groups. Only in the case where it's clearly a woman or a group of women and no men involved will you see the feminine forms. So, you know, it's just by convention. And you see, because this adjective can adjust for, remember, adjectives decline for gender. So if you wanted to make an adjective, suppose it was blind women. Suppose the context was very clear that you're talking only about women. Then you might find tu fly, choli, so forth. You might find a feminine form of that all the way through. But that's going to be relatively rare, because in the New Testament anyway, there's not too many instances in which you're talking only about a group of women. Generally, you're talking in terms of the saints or those that are potential candidates for salvation or something like this, or just mankind in general. And so masculine forms will always be used for a mixed group like that. Yeah?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, protoi there is going to be masculine because it's remember a predicate adjective, even a predicate adjective type of situation. See, is going to be right. It'll have concord with the noun that's being equated to. Right. Case number and gender. All right. Any other questions? Was there another question back there earlier? Or did that get answered?
Would you call protoi at this time an adjective?
Yes. Yes, the last shall be first. It's kind of debatable. You know, you could say the last one shall be first ones, because you could be treating that as a predicate noun, predicate nominative, or you could treat it the last one shall be first as an adjectival idea. It's kind of ambiguous. You really could analyze that both ways in this case. Okay. If it had the article on it or something, then it'd be pretty clear to be being treated as a noun. But because it doesn't have the article, it could go both ways. Yes? Yes, you could. You could eliminate that esontai right there and just have a predicate construction. And you could just say, hoi eskatoi protoi. That's all you need. Now, without any context, then that would be the last are first. If you had the context of the future from the rest of the sentences, then you could still get the last shall be first. And you could get it without the verb form. But you'd have to have pretty good context to make it future. So most of the time with futures, you don't have a whole running narrative in the future, unless you're, say, dealing in the prophetic books. And even there, they usually use present or past tense forms to talk about future in a certain prophetic sense. So I don't know if you really find very often a case where you could make that future verb form there. That's probably why if they want to make it clearly future, they'll use the verb form. But just a simple predicate construction, you could certainly do that. Hoi eskatoi protoi. And you could analyze that as being one of two things, really. You could have predicate nominative construction, like we saw earlier in the earlier chapter, or you could have, and which you would call eschatoi, the predicate nominative, because it's got the article, and the other one without the article, the eschatoi, the subject, because of the article, and protoi, the predicate nominative. Or you could deal with protoi, since you know it's an adjective also, it could be just dealt with as a predicate adjective, just like the constructions we've seen here. So it's one of two. Really, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, though. It doesn't really make a lot of difference whether you're treating protoi as a noun or as an adjective there, because it's the idea that's being transmitted. It's going to get transmitted either way. If you say the last one shall be first ones, or the last one shall be first, doesn't make a whole lot of difference. It's the same idea. Okay? Any other questions on this? All right, we'll get used to seeing this even more frequently when we come to a thing called the participle. Greek uses participles far more frequently than English does. It's hard to find a Greek sentence in the New Testament that doesn't have a participle in it. And so we'll be getting into that later on. It's very interesting. Once you get used to the use of these things, it's a very efficient way to speak. Okay, then, notice in Matthew 11:5, the one above here, the Greek adjectives do not have the article. This is somewhat unusual, as the article is ordinarily used to indicate the substantive function of a word. In this passage, however, there is no obscurity, as there are no other possible subjects. The English translation, however, needs the article, the blind receive their sight, and so forth, or some supporting word like men or people. Well, I'm not so sure about that last part, that we really need it. In other words, you can. I think we can, in English, say blind receive their sight, lame walk, so forth. We can understand that. It's probably a little bit more frequent that we put something on an article or something like that, but I don't know if it's absolutely necessary. By the way, he does seem to indicate here that he makes the statement that the article is used to indicate the substantive function of a word, and this is something to keep in mind. Later on, we'll find a lot of interesting uses. Sometimes you'll find a whole prepositional phrase with an article on the prepositional phrase, showing that the prepositional phrase is functioning as a substantive. So they use this kind of an idea for quite frequently. Then we'll get to infinitives and other things where verb forms will be functioning like nouns, and so this ideas are very interesting. I don't want to barrage you with it now, but I just want you to be aware that this kind of a thing is going to come later on. Mike?
Perhaps then it might be, this might be too much to answer this question then, but I know that there's a whole book about 400 pages on nothing but the article in there.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be a whole lot more going on with this article.
Sure.
Than,
yeah, that's part of what the second year is about in Greek. We're going to spend a good long time on the article and prepositional phrases. But the reason that a book can be that thick about the article is because of these kinds of uses, where you'll see the article used to indicate substantives, make a whole phrase, a whole clause. In some cases, the whole clause will be functioning as a subject of another clause. So, and it's the article that's doing all these wonderful things as far as designating what is what. And then there's the aspects of what the article connotes in terms of definiteness, indefiniteness, and all the ramifications thereof. And then with regard to assigning these positions, you see, it's essentially the position of the article relative to the noun and the adjective that's determining these predicate and attributive positions. And so it's we're going to be looking at a lot of the details of the article. It's one of the most interesting features of the Greek language. Okay, and there's a lot of debate about it, a lot of wrangling and jangling about it too. You know, you get John 1:1 and this type of thing. So, we want to have a good solid understanding of what we can and cannot say about the article, because one person will read one thing in a book and then he'll apply that rule universally, and it won't necessarily be intended to be applied that way, and it won't be appropriate to apply it that way. And that's where I say some people know enough Greek to be dangerous. You know, they know enough of the little rules that they don't know the exceptions. It's like the old adage says, the young man knows the rules and the old man knows the exceptions. And we do need to come to an understanding of just how far we can stretch these things, so that we don't start to jam theology into a passage, you see, and try to stretch the Greek to fit. That's happened far too frequently. So we want to be real careful, so we can be honest about it. Okay, and you can't get that kind of honesty only from books alone, because you'll find places where the books aren't, you know, they're kind of stretching a little bit. We'll show you some examples of that a little bit later on, where the theology begins to dictate something other than what the Greek's indicating. Okay, section 72, one last point in this chapter. Nouns are frequently used very much like adjectives to modify other nouns. So just as an adjective can be used like a noun, so a noun may be used like an adjective in some cases. And when so used are called appositives, or are said to be in apposition. in apposition. And a positive usually has the article and usually follows the noun or pronoun to which it stands in apposition and always agrees with it in case. Will always agree with it in case. Usually it'll follow it. Usually it'll have the article. There are some exceptions to those rules. I can't even call them rules. I guess they're just observations. But it'll always agree with it in case because, you see, the whole point is that it's functioning together with this noun in the same position of the sentence, so it's going to have to agree in case. So basically what we're looking at here are nouns that are functioning somewhat like adjectives. They're further modifying the noun in question. And they usually follow the noun with the article and stand in what we call apposition. Apposition means basically that they're side by side and they're functioning together, the same. So here's some examples. Jesus ho Christos. Jesus the Christ. Now, Jesus, it would be your main noun here, but then ho Christos is in apposition to it. And what's happening is that ho Christos, though it's a noun, is functioning like an adjective to modify Jesus, telling you what Jesus you're talking about, Jesus the Christ, you see. And since Jesus was a common name at that time, Jesus the Christ is designating him more specifically. And so this is functioning somewhat like an adjective would. Ioannes ho Baptistes, John the Baptist. That's telling you which John you're talking about. Ioannes ho Baptistes. Both of them in the same case, both in the nominative case, and the article on the noun that's modifying the other noun. Philippos ho Evangelistes, Philip the Evangelist, same kind of construction. Agrippas ho Basileus, Agrippa the King. But there is a possibility here of a different word order. Ho Basileus Herodes, there is a case in which king comes first, maybe a little bit more emphasis on king. And it may be because of Herod's ego, too. He seemed to be a lot more interested in the title king than most anybody else did, so I don't know if that's the reason why he was always called King Herod. Okay, so this is what we call apposition. We'll find some more interesting uses of nouns this way, and they'll be in the same case. Now, all the examples shown here are all in the nominative case, but that doesn't necessarily hold all the time. In other words, suppose you were dealing with one of these things being the direct object, then you might find it in the accusative case, and you find both nouns in the accusative case, and vice versa. You might find them in any case, but the case of the positive will always be the same as the case of the noun that it's modifying. Okay, questions?
Would it necessarily also be in the same gender?
That's a good question. I don't think we can always say that. Since we're almost always dealing with people, though, in cases like this. In other words, I could imagine a situation in which they might not be in the same gender. Because nouns, you see, have different genders. And if you're talking about an inanimate object, for example, maybe a city or a mountain or something like this, and you're putting another noun in apposition to it, they may not agree in gender. I think the majority of the cases, though, where all these cases, you'll see they're agreeing in gender. And the reason is that you're dealing with a person and usually with an office or a title that applies to that person. And words that describe offices and titles and so forth are generally going to be masculine for positions that men hold. And so for that reason, you probably find the same gender all the way through here. But it's conceivable that you might find a different gender in certain circumstances. Yes?
A strange question, but it has to agree in number. Like, when you have a plural majesty,
oh. Using a plural. Well, I don't know if we find it in the New Testament. I don't think you'll find it in the New Testament. I don't know. I don't know. It just depends. Now in Hebrew, they will do things like that. There is a plural of majesty in Hebrew. But Greek doesn't seem to have one. You know, there even with the word theos, you know, they never use it plural in that sense. So I'm not prepared to say, you know, some of those kings got awful egocentric, you know, and they may use a plural, and we find later kings doing that. I don't know if any of the Greek kings did that. They used titles like Antiochus and the Ptolemies and so forth. Used titles like Soter and Kurios and so forth for themselves, Savior, you know, Lord, and this type of thing. That was common, but I don't know of any case where you're going to see a mixture of singular and plural in these.
So you can have something on the order of the church, the disciples from Ephesus.
Right, yeah. If you have a collective noun, there's a good example. You could perhaps have a situation where you had a collective noun, like the church, and then put an apposition to that, something that is a plural referring to the individuals in the church. That shouldn't be a problem. Okay, Mike? I don't know if you see it, but it wouldn't be a technical problem, I think.
Some of those women, and just call them a disciple, would be a conflict of gender. So you say,
Mary
is a disciple.
Oh, okay. Again, that shouldn't be a problem, really, because a disciple, the term mathetes, I don't think they have a feminine counterpart for it. There may be some cases in which you'll see a feminine counterpart when those things are done, like for slave or something like that. But again, in the New Testament, I think you're primarily dealing with groups. I don't know if you find a case where it's singled out that way and they use a feminine form. You'd have to do some inspection and see if you can find an example of it. So something like that, it wouldn't surprise me to see it go both ways. You know, they might have a word. It just depends on whether they've got a commonly used word for a feminine form of it. If they do, they'll go ahead and use that.
But if they did think the first declension, you wouldn't even recognize those things.
Well, no, you wouldn't unless, a genitive, you would tell a difference, but in most of the cases, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference anyway. So I don't know. I don't know. And these A to Sigma type nouns, I don't think that, I can't think of any that have feminine counterparts. So ones that are built from adjectives generally will have masculine and feminine counterparts. They often come from the substantive use where, see, an adjective will have a set of feminine endings, set of masculine endings, set of neuter endings. And so those are the types of words that you most frequently see if they've been made into nouns. Suppose they were a substantive so long they became a noun, you know, if that's the idea, that they might have both a male and female counterpart. Like for Adelphos, for example, you've got ho Adelphos for brother and hey Adelphé for sister. So you've got basically the same word, but masculine and feminine forms of it. But other words don't seem to have that feature, so we just have to take them as they come, I guess. Okay, any other questions on this chapter? All right, that means for tomorrow we have lesson 9. Let's see how many pages we got on that one. No, it's a reasonably short one. So go ahead and do lesson 9. That's W27, 28, 29, and 30. So it's exercise 9A, 9B, and 9C. 9B takes a lot of pages, but it's pretty quick. And if you want to, on exercise 9B, all you're supposed to do is put an X before the Greek expressions, which is the right translation of this. You're dealing with attributive and predicate positions in all of these. So if you want to, you might also write down whether it's first attributive, second attributive, first predicate, or second predicate position, and which of these four positions it is, just for your own benefit. I'll give you that information when we go through it, but just so you can keep track of these and get used to the labels on those. On 9B. On 9B, if you want, this is a suggestion for your own benefit, but if you want, in addition to finding the right translation, also tell us whether it's first or second attributive or first or second predicate position, what position it is, just so you can get used to labeling those that way. Okay, so we will go over that exercise tomorrow and try to solidify this. We've got a few minutes left here, so we might want to look at the next chapter just to get started with this idea of the genitive case. There's two case forms we haven't dealt with yet. We've dealt with the accusative and the nominative. Now we want to deal with the genitive, and then we'll deal with the dative. First point here, he's doing a kind of an inductive method here. He's going to give you the exercise before you finish the chapter here. But we can get started with looking at some of these examples here first off. The third of the Greek cases to be considered is the genitive. Below are given a number of Greek expressions which contain nouns of the first two declensions in the genitive case. Excuse me. Each is dependent on a noun in the nominative case, but this might have been accusative, genitive, or dative. In other words, a noun in the genitive case can be stuck onto a noun in the nominative, genitive, dative, or accusative in any of the cases. The examples that he's giving you all are examples where you have hodoulos is the noun that is being modified, and then you've got some genitive phrase stuck on that, and hodoulos happens to be nominative. But it could just as easily be a genitive or a dative or any other case. In other words, genitive phrases like this can modify just about any kind of noun in any case. The student should compare these with their indicated English equivalents. So we're going to do kind of an inductive method here to see if we can discern what the endings are. Reference may be made to the following vocabulary. So it gives you a list of vocabulary words here first. I think most of these are on your vocabulary list already.
all of them probably. Okay. I don't know about DSAK, maybe he's the only one. All right, number one, let's look at the phrase and then see what the translation of it is. Hodoulos tou anthropou. Hodoulos tou anthropou means the man's slave or the slave of the man. See, in English we have two ways of writing this. We can write it with a possessive, with apostrophe type of construction, the man's slave or the slave of the man. So hodoulos is slave, tou anthropou means of the man, the slave of the man or the man's slave. And so you see we put another ending. Anthropos is the way it started out. Now we've got anthropou. There's been an accent change. We'll get into the rules for that later on. I don't care that you worry too much about that right now. The main thing is just look at the ending. All right, number two, hoiduloi tou anthropou. Now we have the man's slaves plural, or the slaves plural of the man. So now we have the slaves plural of the man singular. Hoiduloi tou anthropou. Or hodoulos ton anthropon. Now we've made a plural out of the genitive phrase rather than the first noun, and that translates the men's slave, or the slave of the men. So now we've got the slave is singular, and then the men is plural. So it's the slave singular of the men, plural. Number four, hoiduloi ton anthropon. Now we've got both of them in the plural. The slaves of the men. The slaves of the men, or the men's slaves. Number five, hodoulos tou mathetou. The disciple's slave, or the slave of the disciple. Hodoulos tou mathetou. And notice here, this is that word mathetes. Remember that is a first declension. But here, the ending in the genitive looks just like second declension ones. And that's kind of unusual. The kind of ending you'll expect in the genitive for a first declension noun is a little bit different than this. So this is one thing you have to remember about the first declension masculines. The genitive form looks like second declension. But we'll show you that more clearly when we put the whole paradigm on the board. Hodoulos ton matheton, omega nu, ending. One thing you're going to rejoice in measure, I suppose, is that the genitive plural for all nouns of all declensions and all genders is the same. Omega nu, it's always omega nu. Even third declension, all the third declensions and all the oddball forms are all in the genitive plural. It's always omega nu. So that's one refreshing, you know, thing in all of the paradigms. It's always nice to see that omega nu. Okay, genitive plural. It's always genitive plural. All the declensions, all the cases, everything else. I mean, all the genders and all the declensions. Okay, so this means the disciple's slave. The slave of the disciples, plural. And hodoulos tes diathekes, the covenant's slave, or the slave of the covenant. So now we have a first declension noun, tes diathekes. We have eta sigma for the genitive singular ending on a first declension feminine noun. Hodoulos ton diathekon. Okay, and this is the slave of the covenants, plural. And again, we get omega nu here, even in the first declension feminine. They all come out the same in the plural. Number nine, hodoulos tes ekklesias, the church's slave, or the slave of the church. Hey ekklesia is the word for church, and the genitive form, singular, is tes ekklesias. And hodoulos ton ekklesion, there's your good old omega nu again, and that's the plural form, genitive plural, the slave of the churches, plural. Hodoulos tes doxes, the glory's slave, or the slave of the glory. And hodoulos ton doxon, again omega news, would be the slave of the... Now, here he's got either the angelic being's slave, or the slave of the angelic beings. I suppose he's just saying that there may be some instances in which the context shows that you're talking about angels for glories. I'm not sure where he comes up with that, but it's just the plural word for glory here. And that's probably came from apocryphal writings or something like that, it sounds like. That's what I suspect. Hodoulos tes hodou, the way's slave, or the slave of the way. Hodoulos ton hodon, again, the genitive plural is the same. Hodoulos tou technu, and hodoulos to technon, ton technon, for the children's slave, or the slave of the children, that's the last one. Okay, we'll stop there. Those are just a few examples, and then we'll stop and see what we've got there and take a more close look at it tomorrow. So, lesson 9, A, B, and C for tomorrow, exercises.
Yeah, he does. That one I hadn't even noticed before. Just read through it and assumed it was Glory's. Yeah. It does suspiciously sound like apocryphal concept.
Our vocabulary, do we... is that the way you want for... that usually capitalized? It seems as though...
Use small case letters for everything when you're learning it. I think you just need to be aware of it, of what the capitals are, but most of the time we're going to be dealing with a text and we're dealing with lower case letters. So.
I'm surprised that UBS and other groups, this is what I've adopted for lowercase.
Yeah.
I'm able to speak
things. Oh, yeah, right.
That's the terms of quite a bit more.
Yeah.
Don't use that.
Yeah, the only thing that most prints have is this is fatter than this one at all. Yeah, I know what you mean. That's a bit nicer. Sure. Oh, yes, you told me about that. Thank you, brother.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Do you need this back?
No.